welcome to Fossils by Firelight, a series of conversations with South Africa's geological legends, where they unearth their discoveries, learnings, memories, interesting stories, and maybe a few tall tales to chronicle our history and inspire the next generation of geological heroes. Tonight we're talking about everything Fitz and gold. I'd like to introduce our guests to you tonight, starting with Frank Gregory. Frank's an old hand at podcasts already, so welcome back again, Frank. He started his first job with Texas Gulf Exploration in Namibia, then did 24 years at JCR. He was also the founding party of the establishment of the Mineral Corporation, and I proudly worked with Frank for many years. Our next guest is Prof. Bruce Cairncross, and he's an Emeritus Professor at the University of Johannesburg. But he's also a world-renowned author of 14 books and 128 journal articles on mineral-related topics, a photographer with many awards, as well as GSSA awards, the Draper Memorial Medal, the Jubilee Medal, and the Presidential Award, among others. You've even had a mineral, Cairncrossite, which is discovered in the Kalahari manganese field, named in the recognition of your work. Our next guest is Prof. Gillian Drennan, who is the first ever female head of geoscience at the University of Witwatersrand, which makes me so proud. She's also received the GSSA Jubilee Award, as well as the GSSA Honours Award and a number of teaching awards. Our next guest is Prof. Richard Fulyoun, also a podcast expert already. Richard has over 30 years in the mining industry, including 15 years as Chief Consulting Geologist for Goldfields of South Africa. Richard was appointed as an honorary professor at Wits in 1998. He's published over 60 scientific papers and was responsible for publishing of two books, one of the Great Minerals Fields of Africa and the other on Africa's top geological sites. And my co-host tonight is Kate James Kleinhans. She's the curator of the Johannesburg Geology Museum, housed in Museum Africa. Kate, I read an article the other day where you highlighted some of the important artifacts and information contained, not just in the Geology Museum, but in the Museum Africa. So I'm sure we're going to be chatting about those tonight.
Maybe a little bit.
Bruce, Jill, Richard and Kate are all part of the group of Wits alumni from the Geological Museum Association, who advise and assist the management of the Johannesburg Geological Museum. So with all of that, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm going to hand over to Kate, who's going to host this podcast.
So these lovely people around us are all quite good friends, and we all sort of work together and consult together. So we kind of got together in the hopes that we could talk about Wits history and the history of the Witwatersrand in terms of how Wits developed and how it became the amazing city that is Johannesburg and extending out to Carletonville and those areas. And part of what I wanted to talk about was not just how the city developed, but why the city developed and how the gold and the gold mining really affected how the city became the city, but also how that gold mining affected our institutions, so Wits University, and why Wits University became Wits University, and how the gold mining is the reason. So I think Jill will probably know more about the history of Wits, definitely Wits University itself. But also I know that Richard is very well versed in not just the discovery of gold, but also some of the processes, in early processes. Bruce, I know, can tell us all about the mineralization and how important it is and the different types of minerals. And I know that Frank was involved in the early mining, so hopefully we can start with that. So we know that the Wits gold fields were found around
1896.
Yes. We know that the Geology Museum was originally founded at the same time as well as the GSSA. But Johannesburg itself was only really became a city probably about a year after that, and then developed hugely into a city of over 10,000 people really, really quickly. And part of that was the early mining and the early mining exploration. And maybe you guys can try and enlighten us more about that.
Well, if it wasn't for the discovery of gold, Johannesburg wouldn't be here. There are a few anomalies about Johannesburg. It's the largest city in the world, not built on water. It's built on paleo water, from the deposit of the sediments and so on, but it wouldn't have happened. And it was a hot political issue at the time, in the conflict between the Boer republics and the British colonies, and there were strikes and raids and arrests, and people were hanged, and eventually Paul Kruger was forced into accepting the fact that Johannesburg was here to stay, and he decided to be a great benefactor, and he donated two pieces of real estate to each religion. But the Jewish folk, he only gave one piece because they only believed in half the Bible.
I didn't know that one. The water issue is quite interesting, because we mentioned the David Draper Medal, and David Draper actually founded the original water source at Zevichum for the city of Joburg. But before that, there was this really odd situation where Barney Bonatto, who tried to come in as a diamond magnate, was denied basically diamond mining rights by the rest of the landlords because they didn't like him. So what he did is he bought up the city rights. So he bought up a right to build roads. He built up a right to find water. And one of his plans was to build something called the Vierfontein Dam, which is in Mondial. And the Vierfontein Dam actually started building. Then they started construction. They put a Blondin line across the valley. They had the whole lot. But they obviously didn't have particularly good geologists, because they were building the dam on a fault line. And they couldn't find a proper basement for it. So they dug and dug and dug and couldn't fix it up. And then Barney Bonatto was either pushed or jumped off that boat. And the whole project fell apart. And if it hadn't, then where Mondio is now, the suburb of Mondio, which is in the south of Johannesburg, would have been a very nice dam providing water to Joburg. Instead, we had the Zebukom water supply provided by David Draper and his red handkerchief, which is a whole different anecdote. He apparently found the water supply with a dowsing rod and tied a red handkerchief to a tree, but he was being exported forcibly at the time and sent a telegram from Durban going, "Water found, see Zebukom, please return handkerchief." And the rest is history.
What's interesting about, as you said, Richard, the discovery in 1886 by George Walker and George Harrison, is that actually gold in the Witwatersrand area in general, as you probably know, was discovered a long time before that. And in fact, the first recorded discovery of gold in this area was in 1853, 100 years before I was born, actually. Not too far away from here, a certain Jacobus Marais panned gold in the Yuxkay River, and he found some tailings, and then he actually followed it up into the Braamfontein Spruit, just maybe a few kilometers away from here at River Club. And in fact, the road which is closest to the Spruit there's one of the blue plaques up there, and it's called Panner's Lane, yeah, after, you know, in his honor. Yeah, but there's also been controversy about where was it George Walker and George Harrison actually discovered it, because people like John Handley in his book prefers to credit Fred Steuben with the discovery. Because if you look at his map that's in the archives, he, just to the west, going towards Krugersdorp, found gold on what he called the Morella Reef. And that is the equivalent of the main reef along strike that comes to Longlaagte. So although he didn't find it at Longlaagte, he discovered it 3 years before, in 1883, actually, to the west. So, but even so, there's been a lot of inquiries and things about who it was, and it is Walker and Harrison who are sort of officially accredited with the discovery. Mm-hmm.
Could I add to that, Bruce? The interesting thing is that if you go to Zimbabwe and northern parts of South Africa and elsewhere, you'll find that gold has been mined for hundreds of years.
Thousands. Mm.
And the old workings are incredible. There are thousands, literally thousands of gold workings. However, of ancient workings in Zimbabwe and in South Africa, but there was not one single ancient working on the Witwatersrand. Now, that was the big problem, because the early prospectors were looking for gold in quartz veins. And all the gold fields, the major gold fields that were developing at the time, like the Kalgoorlie gold field in Australia, the 49ers in the States, everywhere you go, that gold is based on gold quartz veins. Mm. So the Steubens, and you mentioned the Steubens there, Bruce, they were pretty good prospectors, and they actually discovered a gold quartz vein called the Confidence Reef in the lower Witwatersrand strata. This is long before people knew what was going on, and they started mining this as a gold quartz vein, typical early mining. And it just so happened that they'd also stumbled on the conglomerate, and they had tested the conglomerate. They didn't really understand what it was at that time, and they found very little gold in it. But subsequently, Walker and Harrison brought samples of a conglomerate that they'd seen at the Steubens plant where they were crushing their gold quartz vein, and found that there was indeed gold in this conglomerate rock, but at this time it was extremely rich. And that then alerted everyone to the fact that, hey, the gold is not in these gold quartz veins, it's in the conglomerate. And that was the big breakthrough on the Wits, and from there on, the thing just blossomed, the whole story of gold. Mm. So, and then, of course, leading on to the early history of how Johannesburg developed from that early find, and the importance of that find, a Ferreira's camp, for example. Anyhow, that just to add to what you said. One can continue with the story. So basically my interest really arose from doing an MSc study on the Witwatersrand gold reefs, on the mineralogy and the petrology, through the Economic Geology Research Unit, which was formed specifically to look at research on gold. But one of the first chapters of the thesis was the history behind the gold. So that got me interested in the history of other things like the development of Johannesburg and how that all happened, and the romantic stories of the pubs and the brothels and everything else that went on. Well told in a book by Charles van Onselen. And I think, Kate, you asked earlier on about a problem that arose in the early days, and that was the gold initially was in oxidized rock. So it was easy to extract the gold, which was liberated from the oxidized rock. However, once they got to about 30 meters or so below surface, all of a sudden it changed to fresh rock. And they couldn't extract the gold with their normal processes of chlorination, which was used in the Kalgoorlie gold fields and elsewhere and was very effective, but it was not effective here in the Witwatersrand. So people started leaving, and Johannesburg started becoming a ghost town because there didn't seem to be a future. But then, fortunately, at that time, two Scotsmen had been working on this cyanide as an extractor for gold from sulfide or from unweathered ore, and lo and behold, the cyanide did the trick. The financing became a factor, and enter the landlords.
But even with the cyanidation process, it actually changed the face of Johannesburg as a city. Yes. And this is a recent project of mine, is it changed the face of the north of the city versus the south of the city, and how the areas were seen and who lived where and how those areas developed economically. Which, it's incredible to think that one small factor could change so much in the city.
Yeah.
Well, I dare say it was a huge factor that changed things in the city.
It was one small process.
When you think that since that 1886 discovery, I mean, if you look back in the last 6,000 years of gold production, I think there's a total of about 200,000 tons of gold that have ever been produced. And put that into a cube, we all know that that's about 23 meters cubed, which is nothing. and about 40% of that has come out of South Africa and out of the Witwatersrand Basin. Mm. It is a staggering statistic.
It would be interesting to see how much waste rock has come out in comparison.
Well, it's the grade is averages 5 grams a ton.
Five, yeah.
So there's your answer.
That's a very large chunk of rock.
What's interesting about George Harrison is if you go out towards the east, in front of Eastgate, there's that big statue of him. I don't know if you've ever seen it there. Almost as you're turning into Eastgate, and I'm always intrigued by that because why it was actually erected there and not at Langlaagte, and there's no plaque there either. So for anyone who doesn't really know it, it's just a guy standing, you know, symbolizing seeing the ore actually in his hand. But what's interesting is if you Google George Harrison photos, if you just Google that, you'll get about 100 of George Harrison in the Beatles. But in amongst there is a picture of the statue at Eastgate as well. So he's in there somewhere. Yeah. Okay. But it's quite strange that it's in the east and not actually on the west.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, Bruce. There is one other statue just outside the Civic Center of Johannesburg, the old Civic Center, of a mine worker. And he is looking in a particular direction, and that is towards Langlaagte. Oh. Mm. But it's not George Harrison.
I think that brings us to chatting about the origin of Wits University and the School of Geoscience, which started as the geology department. Because originally we were part of the School of Mines down in Kimberley with the discovery of diamonds. And then when the discovery of gold did take place, there was the need for proper training. And so the origin of the university. And so the department celebrates 118 years, I think we are now. So although the university is currently celebrating its 100th year, we have 18 years on that. And what's really interesting is that mining and geology and chemistry were the early disciplines, and you know, if it hadn't been for the proper training, maybe the gold wouldn't have been as wouldn't have contributed as much if we hadn't trained people to get it out properly. And I think that going forward, I know we're looking backwards, but going forward, we need to be training just as many geoscientists who will be able to continue the culture and the desire for exploration and finding other gold fields and other mineral deposits. And if we're not doing that, we're going to be in trouble. And so I think that it's really important that we learn from the past, but that we look to the future. And I think that that's one of the important things to generate that interest in going out and finding new things and using new technologies. You know, yeah, the change from chlorination to cyanide was a big step in gold exploration and in gold extraction. What's the next big thing? Is, you know, artificial intelligence going to change the way we look at things? And as we get more and more chemically based and use more and more chemical techniques, can we liberate stuff that is in the waste rock that you mentioned? You said, you know, a big chunk of rock that we didn't get any gold out of. But what is in that rock? What can we still get out of it? So I think there's lots of opportunities going forward as well.
Yeah. But also we can also look at how we can go deeper and how the changes in technology, like automation, can we send, instead of sending gold miners down, can we send robots down? And then I'm going to mention a word that's probably not talkable in the industry. What about the concept of the mega mine, where you're going down 3 or 4 kilometers deep into the really bottom ends of the reef that are unreachable by humans because we don't have the technology to do it? Would there be a way to do that using a future way of doing it?
You know, I can comment. I mean, we currently, the deepest mine is just over 4 kilometers.
Yeah.
And in the 80s, when we, when JCI were involved in exploration, we had a couple of deep projects, and one of which was the Fochville project. Quite an interesting story. Most of the projects that we worked on in JCI and exploration were evolved through scientific research and good sedimentology structure, basin analysis, remote sensing, and so on. This one, I was sitting in my office, and Gordon Waddell, our chairman, phoned me and said, come and see me. And this was about 9 o'clock, and he said, I want you to tell me by 4 o'clock this afternoon why we shouldn't be taking up all the mineral rights to the south of the Cartonville goldfields and to the south of Kloof. And by 4 o'clock, I had to give him an answer. And I said, Gordon, there's no geological reason except for the fact that everything is deeper than 4 kilometers. And he said, don't worry about that. Our engineers are happy. And it was quite interesting because that led to, we were now drilling boreholes down to 4 or 5 kilometers. And of course, the good old Sullivan 50 machines we had couldn't reach those depths. And if they could, it would take them 15, 16 months to get there. And when you've got a 3-year mineral option on the property, you can't spend half of that time drilling one borehole. So we introduced seismics into the Witwatersrand Basin, and in fact in that area we did the first 3D seismic survey in South Africa. On-land survey was done at South Deep, and the second one we did at Fochville. And on the basis of that, we then imported 2 oil rigs from Oklahoma. And these things could drill down to 6 kilometers in 2 months. And when we got down to, and we could, because we had the 3D seismics, we could see where the main structures were and we could sight the holes. And we had these incredible machines that cost a fortune. Just even the rate per meter was eye-watering in today's money. And we could drill these holes down, and then we'd bring Schlumberger in from Singapore, and they were a downhole probing company, and they'd do all the testing down the hole and so on. And we drilled quite a few holes down to, the deepest we drilled was about 5,300 meters. Sure. And even when the South Deep mine was planned originally, we were looking then at remotely controlled trucks and so on. So we will be seeing mining down there. The virgin rock temperature down there is about 80 degrees. But if you haven't got people there, it's not an issue. Mm. And the grade's held up.
Could I make a comment? That Frank has brought up the important subject of the use of geophysics. And just want to go back. People think now, see the entire Witwatersrand Basin. However, in the 1930s, all we knew was that there was a central rand, an east rand, and a near-west rand. That is it. That whole scenario changed by the introduction of an instrument called a magnetometer, which measures the magnetic properties of rock and was able to measure the magnetic properties of marker horizons in the lower Witwatersrand and then trace these to the west and develop probably one of the world's biggest gold fields in its own right, the Cartonville gold field. And that was in the 1930s. But it brought in another factor, and that was the use of a multidisciplinary approach to exploration. The use there of Reinecker, who was the consulting geologist for gold fields at that time. He had done work on what were called pay shoots, and that's using sedimentology, because at that time, the early workers, everyone thought, a lot still do think, that the gold was sedimentary in origin, but that's still a bit controversial. Jill and others might comment on that. But yeah, in any event, that I think the use of geophysics was very important. And then after the Cartonville find, the use of gravity and magnetics combined to find the Free State goldfield. After that, the Evander goldfield was found, all by geophysics followed by drilling.
One of those original magnetometers is actually sitting at Museum Africa, and the magnetometer, one of the magnetometers was used to find the orange Free State gold fields. Mm. And it's sitting in a glass case at Museum Africa.
Mm. Yeah. That same magnet, another magnetometer sitting at Gold Fields, wherever their offices are now, in a glass case that found the West Wits Gold Field.
It's not called a magnetometer, it's called a torsion measure.
The interesting thing is that you mentioned geophysics and how important geophysics was. As we got better and stronger computers and as we can work with bigger and bigger data sets, Our team of geophysicists at WITS are reprocessing that historical data. And we're coming up with, our geophysics, the specialists are coming up with new algorithms that are now accurate, much more accurate. So it's a pity we don't have those same drilling rigs nowadays when we can be so much more accurate to within 2 meters compared to the kind of... not hit and miss, but it wasn't nearly as accurate as it is today. And so we're working with the historical data and coming up with very, very interesting models, 3D models, much better, much more refined 3D models, thanks to Musa and his team. There is still a lot there, and certainly geophysics has contributed immensely.
I think one of the red letter days for the Wits Basin was the establishment of EGRU in 1959 and Des Pretorius taking the helm there. And Wits research started it in a big way under EGRU, which was funded by the Chamber of Mines and the University. And you think of the candidates who have passed through EGRU. I mean, there are a few of us around the table here. And, Des Pretorius, in my eyes, was an absolute hero. He was quite a hard guy, as we all remember. But he taught us some really good basic principles, and the principle of how to handle a project. Yeah. And it's that you've got to read the rocks, you've got to record, you have to process, you have to interpret, quantify, and communicate. And that was what I picked up from my honours year. I then joined JCI and had the great fortune, after a couple of years on the mines, of joining Richard's team at Fundamental Research Unit at JCI. And that's exactly what we did there. It was a multidisciplinary approach. And we lived through probably the world's biggest gold exploration bonanza program ever. I mean, we were spending in the 80s up to 600 million rand a year in the Wits Basin. That's 40 years ago, all the mining houses combined. There wasn't one piece of real estate available to be held under mineral rights from Brunfort in the south through to Evander and from Costa down to Vredefort. It was probably one of the most exciting periods of my career.
Can I just bring another point up here, and that is the importance in this whole gold mining industry of financing. That has been crucial, and the ability to do the kind of research, you know, that Frank mentioned, it was all kick-started by the Chamber of Mines, which in essence was a grouping of the major mining houses, about 7 of them at that time. And they initiated a lot of these things. For example, the Chamber of Mines Research Laboratory. That laboratory has done incredible work, world leaders on the problems on the Witwatersrand, the problems of heat at depth, the problems of rock burst, rock mechanics, this kind of thing. That has all been done at the Chamber of Mines, and it's now worldwide technology based on what has been done in South Africa. But the Chamber of Mines, of course, were financed by the mining houses, and the mining houses were financed initially by the Rand Lords. And there's a whole different story going into the Rand Lords, and the history of the Rand Lords is fascinating, and where they lived, the houses they built, etc. But that's a whole different story which can be investigated as well. It's just a spin-off of this, an incredible story.
The entirety of Johannesburg is a spin-off of that story. And one of my favorite landlords is the Dale Laces. Mm. And you read about their history, and after the economic crash, they left and came back, but they couldn't afford to be landlords, so they lived in a really modest house in the south of Joburg that nobody knows about. But just the history of who these people were and what they did, and the fact that they were, we can't idolize them as landlords. We have to idolize them as individual people, because a lot of them were. They were just guys doing the best they could, and some of them fell really flat on really hard times and carried on doing the best they could and still managed to come right. And we always have to talk about that sort of, it's almost, borrowing an American term, a pioneering spirit, where, you know, we're going to take this pile of nothing and we're going to turn it into something amazing, and we're going to do it through hard work and grit. And yeah, we're going to be nasty about it, but we have to, because that's how things work. But through that, we're going to create this amazing thing. And in this case, that amazingness is Johannesburg and is the Wits Fields as we know it. Because without those initial people going, hey, I believe in this, I'm going to invest in this, I'm going to do this, we wouldn't have the situation where we're sitting in now, where we can sit in a podcast studio in the middle of Randburg talking about them. If they weren't here, we wouldn't be here. So we have to sort of acknowledge that historical almost grit and try and carry it forward. We have to try and instill that grit and that can-do attitude through anything into the future, where you can't give up. Life's going to kick you on the ass, but you've got to stand up and you've actually got to kick back.
Yeah. Well, I think they basically were entrepreneurs, okay? And the good example of this is Barney Bonato. Now, Barney Bonato arrived in Johannesburg, he looked around and he couldn't find any claims available. So what he did, as you mentioned earlier, Kate, he started the Johannesburg Waterworks. Didn't matter whether it was water or gold, he was an entrepreneur and he was going to make money out of it. And that was the attitude of these guys. But they did realize they needed expertise to do what they needed to do. And there, Jill has mentioned the importance of Wits, producing the mining engineers, the geologists, the chemical engineers. And you need a whole range of scientists and engineers on a Witwatersrand gold mine. Let's face it, it covers a lot of disciplines. And Wits was the ideal place to train these people. Yeah. So all of these things came together. The mining house system, the entrepreneurs behind it, etc. And that's what made the Witwatersrand.
The interesting side about Barney Bonato, I think it was his daughter was called Primrose, and the only gold mining rights he could get was an area called Primrose, which is still called Primrose.
Yes.
So Primrose, the suburb, is named after Barney Bonato. It was the only rights he could buy. So you've got to look at it sort of in a long-term view as well. Even these entrepreneurs who couldn't get there managed to get there somehow.
He was a funny character. He was a little guy. He was Jewish, but he was Cockney, and he used to box when he was in England. And he got on a ship and came to Cape Town, walked his way up to Kimberley, and ended up owning the big hole of Kimberley. And he was cheated out of that by Cecil John Rhodes. But he got two things out of it. One is he got a fancy check. It was the biggest check ever written in the history of South Africa up to that stage. And he also got a special permission to be a member of the Gentlemen's Club, which previously had denied Jewish folk membership. And he sent his engineer, Rudd, up to Johannesburg because he'd heard about the gold that was happening there. And Rudd got back and reported to him and said, "There's nothing there. I didn't even bother to get off my horse to have a look." And Barney didn't trust him, and he went up to Joburg himself. And Rudd went about trying to get rights, and he got on a ship, went back to England, and he raised money and set up the first South African mining house called Goldfields of South Africa. It's the first money raised in London to finance gold mining in the country.
Richard was also talking about expertise, and I've been doing a lot of research on the south of Joburg and the artisans, and you go and speak to the kids and grandkids of these artisans, and the gold mines were actively recruiting Cornish miners and Cornish coal and gold miners and Welsh coal and gold miners to come out to South Africa because they knew what was going on. And they weren't recruiting them as come out and work as a miner. It was, you've been a coal miner for your whole life. Come out here. We want to do gold mining. We're going to make you a mine manager. And a lot of the guys who are now living in Joburg, who they may not necessarily be the most wealthy people, but a lot of those people have come out because they were actively recruited by these gold miners. They were actively looking for these guys with the expertise.
And it gave birth to a whole lot of other expertise. Infrastructure, road building, South African breweries, glass making, all of that spun off because of the need for providing a mining town with all the infrastructure and the luxuries of glass bottles. I mean, it's amazing the knock-on effect that the gold mining industry had.
My dad always used to talk about secondary industries and how mining was a primary industry and the secondary industry was everything you needed to support a gold miner. And without the second industries, you can't do it. And we often, especially as geologists, we focus on the primary industries and we forget that geologists also need beer and a bed and a couch and a car. And you have to remember those little guys as well. And we have to remember that without those guys, without the plumber, we wouldn't be able to actually function as a city. But the only reason the plumber's here is because the gold miner was here in the first place. So those very early guys created this need and this want, and the need and the want changed everything. And now everything is a feed off of that.
Yeah, I've always believed that geologists are the pioneers and everyone else are the settlers.
Good. Could I... sorry. I just wanted to mention one of the things that has run through this whole business of Witwatersrand gold is to do with finding another Witwatersrand elsewhere in the world. Now, to do that, one has to understand what was the origin of the gold in the Witwatersrand and the mode of deposition of the gold. And this has been a fascinating story of different fields of study. I think the first ideas were that it was part of a river bank, perhaps, the gold conglomerate. Reinecke, I think, was on the right lines when he talked about the pay chutes in the East Rand Basin and the Central Rand. And EGRU, the Economic Geology Research Unit, in the early days was set up, and that was one of the main objectives, to understand these conglomerates. And the use, firstly, of sedimentology was very important. And so people did sedimentological studies on a number of gold mines, and some interesting results were obtained. But then at the same time, Davidson and Bowie in the States were confirmed hydrothermalists. They believed the gold was all introduced hydrothermally. And this set off a huge debate. The debate still rages, in actual fact. And I think Jill and Bruce and others might like to comment on it. But we still don't really know exactly what the main process was for the origin of the gold and how it was deposited and what controls it. The whole story of bugs has come into this. By that I mean early life in the form of oil or hydrocarbons or whatever as concentrators of gold. So there are all sorts of things going around. But as I say, to date, all these ideas have been applied to other parts of the world where there are conglomerates which contain gold and uranium. That's another important component of the conglomerate. But the whole thing is still a bit enigmatic. I think our friends here might disagree, but I think it's enigmatic still. And we've still got a lot to learn. And I think there's still things to be found. I don't think we'll necessarily find another Bhadvarasrand anywhere else in the world. As Frank has said, I mean, we've produced probably 40% of all the gold ever produced on the planet. Where are you going to find another one of those? So, I don't know if there are comments on or your feelings about the origin and finding further Bhadvarasrand gold fields.
I think Jill could probably say something about that, but just maybe before you do, what's I think not that well known, as you say, it's the biggest gold deposit in the world, but if you look at the mineralogy, some of the minerals that have been found in the Wits, there are world records there as well. And in fact, in 1997, I was sitting in my office at the then RAL, which is now UJ, and I got a call from Tim Hewitt, who was working for Anglo at the time, and he said they found some big, large crystals at the Elandsrand gold mine in Carletonville, which is now Kusasalethu mine, and would I be interested to see them and to photograph them? And I said, yeah, sure. I said, can you bring them to me? He said, it could be difficult, but I'll try. So anyway, about a day later, he arrived at my house, and not at the office, and he said, can you help me to take these things out of the boot of my car? And I went there, and here was this 64 centimeter euhedral, perfectly formed orange barite crystal weighing 64 kilograms that the geologist at the time at the mine, Brenda Fries, who was on shift, they were mining the VCR there, at below 2,000 meters below surface. She saw in the footwall there was a bit of a cavity, and she started to scratch around and saw a few quartz crystals. It widened out, and lo and behold, here was this barite crystal and another one, which is even bigger. It's, I think, 75 centimeters and weighs about 74 kilograms. It's my weight. So what she did with her team, they managed to get some beams of wood, and they had some overalls that they made a stretcher out of this thing, and they hauled these two large crystals out of this rug and stuck it on them onto the stretchers. Wow, 130 kilograms, like two dead bodies. And from 2,000 meters below underground, they hauled these things up to surface. And as I say, the one ended up with me, and I took the photographs of them. And as far as I know, they are on display in the mine office. I think they are still there, hopefully, you know, actually preserved. So the largest barite crystals in the world have come from a Bhadvarasrand gold mine. But the other funny thing is sphalerite, the zinc sulfide, the largest sphalerite crystals, if not the world, but certainly from Africa, have also come from a Wits gold mine, from the Welkom goldfield. They were collected there in the 1960s, and the largest one is about the size of my fist, and it's a euhedral crystal as well. So I think these things kind of speak to, you know, what happened to the sediments after they were deposited. I mean, they lithified, diagenesis, low-grade metamorphism, dike intrusion, and I think that probably then leads to the origin of the gold. You know, placer, hydrothermal, modified placer, precipitation from seawater.
All of the above.
All of the above, yeah.
That certainly is a very interesting question, and you're right, we haven't got all the answers yet. And I think that for me, I am a confirmed modified placerist. I've got no problem in admitting that. So yes, the gold probably came in, may have come in detritically. For me, the uranium, you mentioned the uranium, Richard, the uranium, for me, is detrital. The uraninite grains, they are rounded, they're well-rounded, and yes, we see them as angular and as pull-apart grains when they are associated with carbon reef. So for me, definitely, the uranium is detrital, is a sedimentary product, which possibly or probably related to the or resulted in the precipitation of the carbon. And if the gold was hydrothermal, the precipitation of the hydrocarbons from the early fluids that were moving through the basin, which would have been the very earliest primitive oils, which we found in fluid inclusion. So we've got evidence of that. These very primitive oils. And we know that oils today carry carry mineralization as well. So by removing, by the uraninite precipitating the carbon out, the remaining fluid then would have been supergenely enriched in gold. And I think that that's possibly why the filamental gold is always between the carbon spindles. So I think it's a mixture, hence why I'm a modified placerist. I'm not denying that, you know, that there aren't micro-nuggets. There are in some places, and we should expect that. We've got greenstone material which does have the quartz gold veins all around, so yeah, we should expect that. But I think it's a mixture. So, yeah, I'm a modified placerist, and I think that the very earliest, most primitive life forms wouldn't have looked like the algal mats as they are classically described. I think it's really just a function of the precipitation around uraninite that gives it those that spindly structure. So I'm not into algal mats, but I don't mind arguing with somebody who does believe that.
But what's interesting about the carbon or the pyrobitumen is that that in itself has also been remobilized.
Mm. I mean, at least four times.
Yeah, I mean, we've got these, they are samples of pyrite from the West Rand, where you've got euhedral cubes of pyrite, and embedded in them are perfectly formed globules of shiny black kerogen.
Which I've analyzed.
Yeah,
now.
I know, yeah.
And within those perfectly globular bundles of or nodules of pyrobitumen, you have gas bubbles. And when you get down to the nanoscale, with inside those gas bubbles, you see perfectly cubic gold crystals. And they're not attached to anything. It's actually very hard to photograph them because they move when you fire the beam at them. But so there's very much, and that's a late thing because it comes from bugs. It comes from something that's post-depositional.
Mm.
But yeah, getting back to the remobilization, there's at least four different phases of hydrocarbon precipitation, and at least two of them are associated with uranium enrichment. But there are later ones, later phases, and this you can see on a large scale, but you can also see it on a granular scale, where in one single nodule you've got four generations of gold, four generations of carbon, which are themselves associated with gold. Oh.
Yeah, you know, it's the Witz has enjoyed some dramatic deformation in its existence. I remember we had serious structural problems on Doornkop mine, and Andy Killick and his team got to work, and their final analysis, I think they defined something like 17 or 18 phases of deformation just on that particular that property. And you know, if you take a piece of string and you hammer it, anchor it in Longlaughter, and you go south to Frieda Fort, where the conglomerates outcrop on surface upside down, and you take a line there, that main reef goes down to extraordinary depths, and if you put Mount Everest at the bottom of that, it wouldn't pop out on surface. So, you know, when people used to say, when you worked on the Witz gold mines, it was so easy, there was no structural problems or issue. Boy, oh boy. They were guilty of terminological inexactitudes.
And I think that gets us back to the whole notion of technology and deep mining. I think it was, I'm not sure who mentioned robots. I think it was you, Kate, that mentioned robots. I partnered with some of my colleagues in mining engineering, and they were wanting to develop a flyby robot to do geochemical analyses underground. And it was and they needed big samples, and so they came to me to be able to hover their craft that they developed. And on the surface, it worked perfectly. And we were very excited. The problem was that at depth, the laser lens would fog up because of the heat and the moisture. So we had this perfect robot, but it couldn't work underground because of the of the fog. It became impossible. But as we've improved, there's no reason why we can't go deep like that. And that's a whole new revolution. And can you imagine the data that we're going to get out of that?
It would be astounding. Well, the reason I brought up the robots is because it's completely not a gold mine, so completely different story. I was working on a galena mine, oddly, and they have these fantastic articulated trucks, but they're all remote controlled. So the guy actually controlling the truck is sitting in a different truck with a little, it looks like a PlayStation controller, driving this huge articulated vehicle up and down collecting the ore bodies. And that's where sort of the idea of robotics and the human interaction can come around. And if it would be safer for us to send a drone truck or a drone digger or a drone excavator or down into those depths to get the gold out, then we must explore it. We have to look at it because, and this is, again, it's a touchy subject because mining is a touchy subject. The cost of human life is huge in mining, and it's a cost you have to take into factor if you're going to do any mining. But if we can reduce that cost using technology, then we have to do it. And any depths, I mean, I've been down, the furthest I've been down was 2.9 kilometers, and it was, for lack of a better word, hideous. I never want to inflict that on anyone. And the thought of going down to 4Ks terrifies me, because of how hot it is. And it is. It's heart racing, but it's terrifying at the same time. It's daunting and it's amazing. And if you haven't done it, do it, because it changes your entire outlook on roller coasters for the rest of your life. You will never ever be afraid of a roller coaster ever again.
You ought to be in a skip when it skips a loop and it drops.
Look, it is a big issue. As a young graduate, after I graduated, I was at Western Areas and been there 2 months, and I was buried under a rock fall and carried out on stretchers and in hospital and stitched up and so on. And it's a scary experience, and you've got to bury the devil. And the way I handled it is that when I went back to the same stope, sat by myself, and I turned the lamp off, and I sat a shift in the dark and left the devil behind. Because it's a big problem. But in those days, South Africa was producing 1,000 tons of gold a year, but it was costing 1,000 lives every year. One person per ton. And it was exorbitantly high. But we've got to accept the fact that, you know, mining is extremely dangerous. And as Roger Dixon of the Minerals Council so eloquently said, if we want to live in this where we are at the moment, it's either got to be mined or it's got to be grown. But, you know, the equipment that you're talking about is already being used. I mean, yeah. Lawrence, Rob and I visited a copper mine in Myanmar a couple of years ago, and they're already using remote trucks and so on. So it's pretty common in open pit operations at the moment. And that whole operation is all driven on software packages. It's extraordinary.
You've got coal mines in South Africa that are also remotely controlled like that.
Yeah.
Resolute Mine in West Africa.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's common already, and at depth it's not a big issue. You know, again, the mining method, the geology should determine the mining method, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. We had some issues with that in JCI at one time. Where you've got packages like the South Deep, you know, in the upper Ellsbergs. Boy, big trucks and remote operations are tailor-made for it.
But I think the problem isn't so much the technology, it's more the unions who don't want to be done out of a job. It's a more of a socio-political thing than a technological issue.
And it was a long time ago as well, when Oppenheimer had to make the decision, did he go remotely or, you know, did he mechanize? And he made the decision that it was more important to feed the miners because you fed the families. I think at that time, for every one person employed on the mine, there were eight or nine people. So it is an important socio-political question, for sure.
I think we there long. Mm. There's a long, you know, the Wits Basin has always been haunted by politics, right?
Always.
From Kruger's days, right through to, the gold boom that we lived through in the 80s with exploration. The whole thing was driven by the sanctions that we were experiencing in South Africa. We could not operate outside of this country. The gold price was threatening to take a positive run, and there was nowhere else to go. And so we hit the Wits Basin big time. But it was, that whole thing was driven politically, and it continues to be to this day. Yeah.
I wonder if I can just ask Bruce a question here. You talk about the minerals in the Witwatersrand. I think something like 140 different mineral species have been identified. This is more than any other deposit I know of. And there's some very interesting associations of the gold with things like the nickel arsenides and so on. I've often wondered, what the heck has this got to do with the origin of the gold? Because I'm sure there's a tie-up, but the mineralogy is pretty complicated, as Jill has said as well. So how does one interpret all this information to make a meaningful thing about where did it all come from?
Yeah, I always have a disclaimer. I'd say I'm not a mineralogist, I'm a coal sedimentologist. So
when it comes to a question like that.
First of all, there's a website called mindat.org, which is the mineral website in the world. And on that website, there are, I think, 110 species that are listed for the Wits. Including two type locality species that were discovered there. Isoferroplatinum and Morderite come from the Wits. But there are other deposits that have got more minerals. I mean, the Sumeb mine has got over 250. Mont Saint-Hilaire in Canada is also, Franklin, New Jersey, they've got 300-400 species. But those are different, more sort of complex than just a gold mine.
Sure.
And a lot of the minerals are diagenetic, and a lot are actually detrital. And, that's what, that again comes into the origin of the gold, detrital, diagenetic, hydrothermal, whatever. But the actual association of individual sulfides with the gold, I really can't answer that. My interest is more in the aesthetic part of the mineralogy from the Wits and the preservation of it as well. Because there are not many collections of Witwatersrand supergroup minerals, actually, if you look around, whether it's here in South Africa or in big international museums overseas, and especially gold specimens, because a lot of those gold specimens, as you know, come from gold fields.
Hmm.
You know, these very spectacular secondary golds associated with the vein quartz, for example, and they are rare. And you're quite right, very seldom seen, actually, elsewhere. Yeah. But, I mean, there's a reason for that as well. As you know, the Precious Metals Act, it's against the law for anyone to possess unwrought gold. So unless you are a museum or a tertiary institution with the necessary permits, you're not supposed to own them.
And we've got those.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'm just going to go hard, Ma, now.
Quick. You and me both, have you got a good hiding place? Cool,
One of the highlights of my 4 years of working on the mines was I found a gold crystal, which is now in a private collection overseas. But I dug it out myself, and it was absolutely stunning.
But isn't it sad, though, that, and because we all are part of Museum Africa, isn't it sad that so many of the really spectacular samples are no longer in South Africa, and we just don't have the budget to buy the specimens and to bring them back?
Yeah. There was that dreadful break-in at the Wits Mineral Collection in the early 70s where those green diamonds that had been extricated out of the Wits were stolen.
Mm. What's interesting about those diamonds, the earliest ones were found in Clarksdorp in the late 1800s in the sluice boxes. And I think it was maybe some of those that ended up in the Blaerlock Museum at Wits and at Museum Africa. But there are others that were found up here as well, in the Central Rand as well. There's a paper by Rahl in the 1960s who actually had a look at some of these, because they're all green. But it's just a green rind on the outside, and that's been explained, which he it was his interpretation that it was due to the irradiation of the uranium in the conglomerates. It was irradiating the outside of these diamonds, but the insides were still clear. And of course, the one, there's no debate about that, but those diamonds are detrital. So the implication is, although we do know diamonds are quite old, but obviously they had to predate the Archean age of the sediments in the Wits Basin. So there's evidence for very early Archean diamonds somewhere on the Kaapvaal Craton that got eroded in with the gravels and the gold. So in fact, it's a gold deposit as well as a diamond deposit, yeah, albeit not very economical diamonds, but interesting nonetheless.
On that score, Bruce, in the East Rand, in the early days when they used the sluice boxes and they didn't crush the diamonds, they extracted diamonds. Mm. And in fact, one of the mines there was known as the Modder, I think it was the Modder East Gold and Diamond Mining Company. How about that?
Yeah.
Besides the uranium there, they mined diamonds economically, and they, while it lasted. So where the heck did all these things accumulate? I just find it phenomenal.
Yeah. We're just right about out of time, so just as a close, and just Frank gave me an idea, could everyone just mention their favorite Wits gold reef specimen, possibly?
Favorite.
I can start. I actually have two, so it's a bit cheating. At Museum Africa, there is a ammonite that has been replaced by pyrite, and it's beautiful. But the other one actually comes from JCI's South Shaft, and it's a perfect door wedge shape. It's a wedge of conglomerate. It's gold reef, but it has a layer of pyrite over the top. So it's incredibly sparkly, incredibly shiny, but it's a perfect wedge for a door. And it's actually my door stopper in my passage door at home.
Yeah, well, look, I had quite a few samples. I had 10 samples that were spectacular. And probably the best of the lot was a South Reef from Randfontein Estates. And the gold was actually on the four sets of the quartzites on the ripples as these sediments migrated, and the gold was along each faucet and obviously along the basal scour as well. That sample I found in a dustbin. Randfontein Estates were closing an office, and it was one sample that they'd forgotten to ship off to the plant. Yeah. And it was in a dustbin, and I picked it up. And
what were you doing digging in the dustbin? You must have really been hard up.
We were poorly paid mine geologists.
Nothing's changed.
Mine was a piece of carbon leader with about 1.5-2 centimeters. With a lot of visible gold and columnar carbon. However, I've donated it to Gillian and others. And
portions of it. Only portions of it.
It's been cut down, but it's still there, Jill, you'd like to know. But that is a spectacular specimen. I haven't seen anything quite like it elsewhere. And the other one was a sample of VCR with the most incredible rounded pyrite pebbles, absolute pebbles, flattened pebbles, unbelievable, beautifully preserved. So those I've enjoyed.
Could I be rude and interrupt there about your carbon leader? Just a very quick story. We had a client, and he wanted Chinese investors, and I was asked to give the presentation, and I thought communicating with Chinese folk is quite difficult, so I took those 10 samples I was talking about. And the Chinese loved the samples. They hated my presentation, but they invested in the property. And the owner of the property then asked, who did that carbon leader sample belong to? And it was, mine wasn't as nice as Richard's, as I know you're a piece. And he said to me, I will buy it from you. And I said, well, it's actually not for sale. Anyway, years later, a colleague of mine living in the Cape had a piece of that carbon leader on his mantelpiece. He lives in Betty's Bay. And one thing led to another, and I've introduced the two of them, and he paid him £12,000.
Pounds?
Oh, wow. You should have taken that deal.
You wouldn't have had to dig in the dustbin if you sold your sample.
I must tell you the story about how I I came to be with that sample, I had a girlfriend who worked for Anglo American. And she came along one day and said, Anglo has been clearing out some cupboards or something, and I found this sample there. Are you interested? So I said, yeah, okay.
Marry me. Not worth it.
So I got it from a girlfriend who worked in Anglo-American about zonk years ago.
And then he dumped her.
And then I dumped her. I said, aren't there any others there? You know?
And he gave the sample to you.
A portion of his
and
sample
she
to me.
Back half in half. So it's had a hell of a career, that sample.
So we share a sample, and it's really one of our favorites. Richard and I have this bond. And it all goes back to his ex-girlfriend. But my other, I think my second sample is the little gold, perfectly euhedral gold cube that's inside the bubbles that are inside carbon nodule that are inside the recrystallized pyrite. It's really unique and very special. It was very exciting when we found that, because we'd been looking at the carbon for a long while, and we'd seen on the surface of the carbon nodules that we had extracted from the quartz veins, the remobilized quartz veins, we had seen that there were these sort of rupture marks that looked like they had actually exploded. And people thought I was mad. I was saying, look, it looks like a volcano. No, you're mad. I said, there has to be gas bubbles. And then when we actually were doing the very high magnification photography, and we saw these tiny little these gold grains, perfectly cubic, that was just a very special moment. Very special moment.
I think for me, look, it's hard to say, but there'd be two specimens, none of which I own, unfortunately. But I think the one has to be the McIver octahedral gold crystals in the Fitz collection. I mean, that is just so iconic.
That's in the Christmas tree.
Yeah, but specifically the octahedral crystals, you know, that they stand up proud like a chimney on that piece of white matrix. It's been on the cover of his book for decades now. That is really one of the, I think, the top specimens from the Fitz Goldfield. I've actually photographed a lot of Fitz Gold specimens for various mining houses and museums, and I think they're bigger ones, but that one, to me, would be my favorite gold. And from a mineral standpoint, I think it has to be the giant barite crystal from Kusasalethu. I mean, that thing is just so off the charts. I wouldn't like to have it in my collection because you wouldn't be able to pick the thing up to move it around, but that's a fantastic specimen.
So my favorite specimen would have to be the Lord of the Rings gold ring that Harmony created. I was working there at the time, and I was a very proud owner of my Lord of the Rings gold ring. So thanks very much for joining us tonight. Fascinating stories. I personally would love to go back to the heyday of the Wits gold, where it was picks and axes. But obviously we've all moved forward, and the technology that's coming out and that's going forward is phenomenal. So I'd like to thank you all for joining us tonight. And everybody else, keep an eye for our next podcast.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.